Have you heard the birds sing, the trees breathe, and the rain fall? The stories we tell ourselves are what create our reality. Hi, I'm Julia, your host, and you're listening to Terra Stories, the podcast that will awaken your mind to new perspectives, to reconnect to yourself, to nature, and to become an actor of change in tomorrow's world.
And I spent my childhood playing up and down in those woods. And through that connection, I started feeling a little bit more solace. And then this brilliant, magical thing happened where I learned the names of the trees. And it always starts with the trees. They are groundkeepers. They are signs in the woods. They hold space. Each tree holds its own community near it. And no longer did I feel like this kind of lost little Venezuelan girl, these big Canadian woods. I felt like a friend visiting oak and visiting dear maple and waiting so patiently every spring to see the new buds come out and we're like, oh, you're back, my dear friend. I missed you over the winter.
Anna was raised in Venezuela with her family, who had been cattle farmers for generations. They, from whom she inherited indigenous ancestry, maintained a deep connection to the land. However, due to increased governmental pressure, she was compelled to leave with her parents for Canada, thus becoming separated from her family, homeland, and culture. Growing up far from her ancestors' lands, Anna found solace through meaningful encounters and the nature around her. By exploring the forest whenever possible, observing her surroundings, foraging, and learning the names of the trees, she cultivated a sense of belonging to her new environment. Embracing her indigeneity, Anna's worldview evolved. How did she forge this profound bond with the forest? And what experiences did she encounter there? Follow Anna's journey as a forager, activist, and influencer. Hi, Anna. So happy to have you on Terra Stories. It's been a while we're talking and in contact, and I'm so happy to share your knowledge and your wisdom with Terra Stories audience. So if you want to introduce yourself to the people who don't know you yet.
But sure. My name is Anna Mercedes. I am right now. I come from the territories of Anzoátegui in Venezuela. I am an indigenous woman. Some people know my nation as the Carib Nation, although the word Carib is a slur, so it's amusing for us that you're known by a slur. And I think that is a really interesting way to kind of begin the story of what it is to be a little Kalitna girl who was born in Venezuela and found her way all the way up north into Anishinaabe territories in the area of Ontario in Canada.
And I was looking at you and she has an amazing sweater with mushrooms on it. They have to know, Anna.
They have to know
because it's amazing. So before diving into your path and you going to Canada and your experience, maybe can you share more insights about your childhood? Who's the community you grew up with? What did you learn from them? Yeah, what is their relationship with nature and the world around them?
So I am Adyaneta. That's so many fun, interesting intersectionalities of identity as a Venezuelan. And many of us Venezuelans have these intersectionalities that we kind of work within. So my family are all cattle farmers. My grandmother, my grandfather, They have been cattle farming in Venezuela for generations upon generations. My grandfather, he's where I get my Magdalena side from. So they've been connecting to those lands since time immemorial. And then on my grandmother's side, they've been collecting to those same lands. They haven't moved for 300 years. So I'm the first one of my family to grow up outside of Venezuela on one end since time immemorial and on the other side for 300 years. So it's been interesting because my connection to the land is so deeply rooted in my home country. My grandmother can tell you all the plants and their medicinal uses. And when I had to leave Venezuela because we had a coup in 2002, and my mom is a lawyer, so my mom did a lot of legal writings, and she was warned that her writings were getting too political and she could be on a list. So because of that, and in April 2002 during the coups, my mom was in a march, a protest. I've been protesting since I was 5, so luckily it was not this protest with my mom. The police and the military started shooting at each other, and my mom and a lot of Venezuelans were kind of caught in the middle. And after that, my parents got really scared, like many other Venezuelans. So in 2003, we became part of the diaspora, and I moved to Canada with my mom and my dad and myself and my little dog, Nini. She's the darlingest little poodle. And we ended up in a small town in Canada. And here it was, this little Venezuelan girl taken from her family, her lands, her culture, everything that she knew because of governmental unrest. And my parents were just trying to find a better life for us. So we moved to a small town, and it was equally an extremely difficult experience, but also an extremely beautiful experience. The town I grew up in was really racist. I was the only Latino in my whole school board. It was painful because a lot of people have a lot of incorrect ideas about Latina people. Had teachers telling me, like, why do you bother going to school? You're just going to be a maid. And for me, that was so confusing. It was brutal. It was so confusing to me because I had my mom who's a lawyer. You know, my family, my mom's generation, they're all doctors, lawyers, and engineers. And before that, proud cattle farmers. So,
and you had maybe also this idea, saying your family, this idea, this beautiful idea of your family and who they were as individuals. And it was maybe difficult to see yourself in this, you know, group of people they were thinking you were. That was so different of who you were growing up with, right?
Entirely. And it made me question my reality. It made me question, you know, are Latinos all maids? Like, I was so confused. And I remember just trying to find solace somewhere where I felt safe. And luckily, my parents, the house that they bought, backed on to woods, and it was deeply forested. So I spent most of my childhood playing in the woods. It was me, Mimi, my little dog, and then we got my bigger dog, Bear, who's also just a joy of a being. And I spent my childhood playing up and down in those woods. And through that connection, I started feeling a little bit more solace. And then this brilliant, magical thing happened where I learned the names of the trees. And it always starts with the trees. They are ground keepers. They are signs in the woods. They hold space. Each tree holds its own community near it. And no longer did I feel like this kind of lost little Venezuelan girl, these big Canadian woods. I felt like a friend visiting oak and visiting dear maple and waiting so patiently every spring to see the new buds come out. And we're like, oh, you're back, my dear friend. We missed you over the winter. And then
you learned that by yourself?
I was a really curious kid. And, you know, every other member, I guess my family, at least before my line, had the ability to be taught by their elders about the land around them. But I was the first one to be in these new territories. It was up to me to learn the land around me and to create those relationships. And in some way, it was a good thing that And it was kind of tough for me in my small town because I returned to nature for care and for solace. And my whole life, my mom was always reminding me that we are indigenous peoples, that we should be connecting to the land, we should be connecting to our ancestors. And because of that, and my parents are total tree huggers and total dorks. So if I showed an interest in anything, they would buy me like the encyclopedia, you know?
Yeah.
So they're very, it was because honestly, a lot of it was because of my parents. They just fed my curiosity and they were willing to kind of sit down and listen to all my funky ideas about the world. And because they created that safe space for me, it kind of started coming out, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, because sometimes we feel like depending on the people you're around, some things can seem woo-woo, you know?
Yeah.
And some things seem essential, you know? And it's important to be around the people that push you to connect with natural spaces. So you arrive there. You try to connect with the land, trying to feel in those lands home. Did you meet people around you that were experiencing the same thing as you? Did you try to meet indigenous communities also that could help you? Like, what did you do more than just trying alone to recreate that feeling of home?
Honestly, it wasn't until I was an adult. It wasn't until I was in university. I went to university in Toronto. At the University of Toronto, I studied politics and international relations. And then halfway through, I was like, none of this fits with me and I hate it. And then I took on an Indigenous Studies course. And in Indigenous Studies, I got to meet Lee Miracle, who is a Stolo activist, writer, academic. She is a fairly big deal here in Canada. And in one of her classes, we were introducing ourselves. And I jokingly said, oh, I'm Native, but just the wrong kind of Native, you know, referencing to the fact that I'm a South American Indigenous person. And she stopped me right away. And she said, you stop that right now. Because everyone else in the world will try to tramp down your indigeneity and will try to stop you from taking up your rightful space as an Indigenous woman. You cannot open that door for them. You have to stand strong in your power as an Indigenous woman. And, you know, here I was, like, 19-year-old me, just mind-blown by this. And she was basically like, go touch grass. And from that experience, it opened up a whole new world to me. I started eating up as many books as I could about Indigenous knowledge, Indigenous land relations. And it really, I've always felt untethered, even though I've been connecting to the land. And I think it's because being an Indigenous person, I understand what it is to connect to your own territories. The feeling of knowing that you are putting down seeds that your ancestors have put down in the same lands. And you cannot replicate that feeling anywhere else. Everywhere I went, I recognized that I was a visitor. And that recognition of being a visitor on lands you're not my own changed me in a profound, beautiful way because it made me think about what I was trying to get out of the land. Because as a visitor, you know, when you go to someone's house, you're extra polite, you know? You don't just keep your feet up and you put them on the coffee table. You tidy up after yourself a little bit more. You're a little extra careful about where you step, what you do, because you recognize that you are visiting. And that really changed my connection to the land and really changed how I approach foraging and how I connect. One of the things that I really learned in school and just talking to other Indigenous leaders was how we Indigenous peoples shape the lands we live on. When first comers came, they describe all the time about these lands in the Americas, talking about being in Eden, in a paradise. That was not by accident. That was from active, intentional Indigenous land management. And we've gone away from that because writers like John Locke, who is a really important philosopher when it comes to the building of British and Canadian politics, these writers really discussed Indigenous peoples as these kind of like animals, you know, and not understanding that it takes active land management to make things thrive. And I, one of the things I really felt like being a visitor, knowing that these lands carried me, you know, the trees behind my house were there for every breakup I've had, you know, every good grade or bad grade, every time as a teenager where I was like, ugh, my parents just don't understand me. I knew that oak tree behind my house would understand me. It made me think, what can I give back? What can I do to say thank you to this land that so caringly and lovingly sustained me? And through that, I started Anna in the Wild, which is my TikTok and Instagram page where I talk a lot about foraging, how to be a good forager. You know, when you see mushrooms, as you walk by them, give a little tap on the head, it makes their spores go out, you know? Or collect your seeds too when you see wildflowers. Know, you know, what territories you're on. Right now, I'm on the territories of the Cree. And it's so important to know these things because it also helps you know. No, I'm in the Carolinian forest region. So if you know your forest region, you know the people who lived in these regions, and you know that it was indigenous land management that made these regions so biodiverse, then the story changes. Then native plants and native people aren't a separate topic. They are one in the same. So when you kind of come to those understandings, you then start kind of realizing where you fall in kind of this greater scheme of things. And because I had to leave because of political strife, and it felt so difficult being part of the diaspora alone, the land gifted me everything. So now as an adult, I feel like it is my responsibility to give back to the land as much as I can. And I do that through my education, but also through my foraging. People always think about foraging as taking. You're taking what the land gives you. It gives you, and you take. And that is such a Western idea of how to interact with the land. But really what it is an act of gratefulness and an act of love and an act of recognition. You know, sometimes you go out, some of my favorite mushrooms are enoki or velvet foot. Or velvet shank muscle, velvet shank mushroom. This mushroom, you see it in stores, it's like white, you know, enoki mushrooms are just like pure white. They're kind of like 6 inches big and they're used a lot in Asian cooking. But when you see them in nature, because in the ones that they grow are kind of like grown in dark spaces, so that's why they're all white. But in nature, the sun hits them. So they have these beautiful little velvet feet and these great, beautiful orange caps. And they can fill 3 or 4 trees all the way up as far as the eye can see, just mushrooms. And you're reminded just the insane abundance that this planet is. This planet is so abundant. And there is enough food and enough resources for all of us. We just need to go back to our roots. And those roots really differ depending where you are. And in the Americas and in Australia and all these places that were kind of conquered, were managed by indigenous people. And it's these connections to the land that we have, and by observing, respecting, and honoring. If we go back to that, we will have everything that we need. It's astounding. Honestly, fungi are so incredible. But even you go out and see like a walnut tree and you see it has so many walnuts that its branches will sag down in weight. And that is a gift to you, to the squirrels, to land around you. And once you realize that you're just being gifted thing just for existing, all you have to do is just exist. And the universe gifts you everything you need. That ability to accept gifts that are natural makes you want to give. It makes you want to, every time you see someone, when I'm hiking, I'm the kind of person, if I have a whole bunch of walnuts, I'm walking out into a path and I scare people all the time because I'll just like step out onto the path and someone will be walking there and they'll startle. And I'll be like, would you like a bunch of walnuts? And there I am, this random being in the forest.
Who's that lady?
And you know what? Almost every single time, people are like, yeah, I would like a bunch of walnuts. And can you tell me more? Like, where did you get them? How do they work?
Yeah, That's beautiful. I picture myself also when I go for hikes with my friends. So here we have a lot of lavender, thyme, those kind of herbs. And I love picking them and then doing vegetable oils. And I always tell the stories of those plants. It's so easy to go to the grocery store, to go to the pharmacy and find things that are already made up. But when you eat something you picked up or you heal yourself, you know that the vegetable oil you put, for example, on your chest because it's difficult to breathe and there is thyme inside and it's the thyme you picked up in the forest, everything has deeper meaning and you do things more consciously, I think.
I agree with you. And the story.
There is a story, right? And it's therapy. Like, do you think also you were saying that it was your home? Do you think it's healing you?
Oh, every way. Oh, trying not to tear out. But this land has healed me with so much love and care and joy. And it is reflected by the very peoples who gifted and took care of this land. I cannot say enough about just the big hearts of the Anishinaabeg people. They're the territories whose territories I live on. And every time I go to friendship centers here in Canada, we have Indigenous friendship centers that you can go and you can visit. And they're kind of hubs for Indigenous people. As we know, Indigenous people all over the Americas, we have all been displaced and moved around because of resources, so they were easier to take from us. So moving around Canada, Indigenous people aren't always where their traditional lands are, so friendship centers are really good places for everyone to kind of go and meet. And I was expecting to be turned away at the door. You know, I was so used to these colonial systems where they're like, you're Venezuelan, you're not Canadian. Bye, get out of here. But when I showed up and I was like, hi, you know, I'm a Kalina, I'm a visitor, I'm a guest, but I'm Indigenous. And I felt like I was just holding so much of my own sorrow, my own traumas, my own pains. And a lot of these come from, you know, it's intergenerational trauma. It comes from, you know, surviving, being a survivor of genocide, because that's what we are. And I had the people around me just accept me with so much love and joy. They took my sorrow and they held it together. And I took their sorrow too. And I feel that that is something recently we really need to have pay attention to with the genocide going on right now in Gaza. All of us are feeling like we have to hold the entire sorrow of the world on our own shoulders. Like we ourselves have to carry the pain. But really, it's not. It's all of us as a community that hold that sorrow together. And when you come into a community and you can share and hold space for pain, you also have the ability to hold space for joy and for hope and for planning and for communicating. And you see this reflected in the trees. The trees are always communicating with each other. Walnuts and other nuts.
They're so intelligent.
Right? They're so smart. They have these things called boom years, and every tree in that county or in that region will go through a boom year. And they connect with each other. They talk to each other and they know, like, okay, this year is a boom year. We're going to have all of the walnuts or all of the hazelnuts, whatever it is. And they will all do that together because they're like, oh, there's a necessity. Okay, let's do it. And we can take so much from just observing the natural world.
Their wisdom.
Yeah. And just sitting in that. And I feel like that's where a lot of Indigenous knowledge comes from, is generation upon generation of observation and coming together and having that space to come together to discuss our observations is so beautiful and critical. And that's one of the major things that I've been taught by nature.
Yeah. I think what is beautiful of what you're saying is that I feel like Western culture is waiting for answers and conversations with other human beings. Like we're a species that is only like thinking between species, you know? And I feel like I'm not part of an Indigenous culture, but what I feel you're telling me is that you're having from 400 of years conversation with nature also.
Yes.
With other species that are not talking, but they are
communicating
in other ways, and they're sharing wisdom, they're sharing so much knowledge that you as species, and also when I'm watching a beautiful series and you see that trees and the forest, nature was there like million of years ago, and you're like, we should learn from that.
Yes, and all the knowledge gained by, you know, the trees and the animals around it, and just taking a moment to sit still in nature is so critical. I feel like, you know, in these Western societies, it's always about the next thing. It's always about going and moving. And we don't take the space anymore the way we used to, the way the land does, to take a break and to stop and to think and to feel. And that feeling is so terrifying for so many of us. And I think that comes from a lack of community, because we feel like we have to feel alone, and we don't. You know, all these big feelings are big emotions that we've all felt, you know, since time immemorial. You know, like we were seeing when it comes to, like, you know, man versus nature. Right now we're feeling man versus nature a lot too, you know, with climate change and, you know, experiencing these bigger environmental events. If we come together and kind of discuss how we're feeling about those things, we will also start discussing solutions, because humans are very solution oriented. And I think it's about really creating those spaces, the way nature creates those spaces to rest, to recuperate, you know, to in the winter, all the sap goes down into the roots of the tree, and it does a lot of work, because underground in those roots, there's fungi and bacteria, and all of these things are intermingling together and resting. And in the spring, that sap, the sun warms up the top of the tree and it makes it kind of release a hormone, and the sap starts flowing up again. And indigenous people here in North America literally tapped into that sap and have made maple syrup from that. And it's really just this, and when they did make maple syrup here, that's when all sorts of families would kind of go to their own winter lands. And then in the spring, when the sap was running, all the families would all come together, be massive camps in these huge fields of maple, where they would come together and talk to each other about what they rested on, what they learned while they're working to the new year, because that the sap will run in March. So that's the beginning of spring, and it's the beginning of that new cycle. And I think if we start feeling and existing cyclical again, part as a community, creating that time and that space, is so critical, I think, to our advancement and to heal a lot of the sorrows we have, and healing those feelings of impotence that we have right now, you know, watching things and hoping to kind of make a change. And you can do that through the smallest little bits, you know? And that is something that I've been thinking a lot lately, because when you think about the environment and you're caring about nature, it's not just your lands and the lands you're on. You're thinking about all other indigenous peoples and their connection to the land. I think about Palestinians and their olive trees, and I hold their sorrow with me in the same way that I hold sorrow for my people and my rivers that are being destroyed for the hunter of oil and gold in Venezuela. We have a huge problem with that. And it's the understanding that all of these whose sorrows are interlinked, and coming together in community to solve these things. And it's specifically that coming together in community that these kind of bigger states are stopping us from doing, because they recognize the power in it. And we talk a lot about building community, but it is as simple as going outside and learning the name of the tree that is in front of your house. And it is as simple as calling your best friend and being, hey, how are you feeling? Do you want to come for a walk with me? That's it. That is all you have to do. And it feels like, you know, when we say build a community, it's like, oh my God, I got to deliver a pie to my neighbor next door.
We see it a Western version.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
It's that like
the big thing to achieve and stressful, and But no, it doesn't have to be this.
Nature teaches us that. Nature teaches us how to build community. It teaches us how to come together. It teaches us when to rest and when to work.
And to go slowly, like in the series I'm watching, sometimes it took millions of years and we're rushing always into things. And I think I loved that you were talking about cycles, about seasons, and the nature and the forest has also its cycles. You can go in the forest during winter, you won't find the same forest that you experienced in summer. And I love how you see cycles and how you're excited to see nature changed during the season. I don't know if you have anecdotes to share with us.
It's so interesting. So I'm in Amazon, right? So we have rainy season and dry season. So our cycles are different. And coming here, it was hard for my Caribbean self to be, you know, minus 20 weather. And I used to just not like winter very much until I learned the names of the trees, until I started connecting and realizing that I didn't want my friend oak to have to be producing all year round. In fact, I really loved for my friend when he dropped his leaves and decided to take a break. I was like, oh, thank goodness, Mr. Oak, that you're taking a break. You fed me, the squirrels, the plants around you, so many fungi and bugs and bacteria that live off of you. Take a break, my dear friend. And then in the spring, okay, this part is amazing. So in the Carolinian forest region, we have some of the most wildflowers in the world are found in this area. And that's because we are like a 2-week cycle for each plant. It's a symphony. These guys are called spring ephemerals. Ephemeral just means that they're not around for very long. Most of these plants will flower 3, maybe 5 days. Not very long. And they come in a cycle. And it is spectacular. First, you will see your friend trout lily, and they have the most beautiful, delicate little yellow flowers. So you'll see the snow starting to melt. Then you'll see the side being spotted, blink, 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 little yellow flowers. And they're only around for a few days. So you have to be outside to say hi to them and greet them with joy. And these beautiful flowers, they're also called sometimes houndstooth lily, because if you dig them, they have this thing called the corm, which is like kind of like a potato is like a corm. It's like a bald kind of root. But they taste like if you were to soak cucumber in sugar water. They're just sugar bombs. So yummy and so lovely. And you can only get to them, you know, very small times during the year. So you're just waiting for your friends to show up. One of my favorite plants in the Carolinian region is called bloodroot. I'll send you a picture. The leaf of this plant is so beautiful and lobe, and the flower will only come out for 2-3 days max. And it's the most delicate little white flower that you see spotting across the forest floor. And you don't see it for very long. So you have to enjoy the plants when they come out. And it really makes you live in the moment. It makes you kind of sit in the cycle of it all, because you know, I'm equally excited to see my good friend bloodroot. But then way later on in the season, we'll get this flower called the cardinal flower, which is a tiny little native plant. It has bright little red flowers. That's why it's called the cardinal flower. And it is spectacular. Only comes out in the late fall. So with these cycles, you're just kind of waiting to see your friends again. And you take up as much energy as you can with them. And you say, thank you so much for your energy, little friend. And they go feel back grateful. To sleep. Yeah, and they go back to sleep and do their thing. And you get to spend time with your next plant. And it's so exciting because once you start kind of getting used to the cycles of nature, you start looking forward to different bits. So some parts of the forest in the spring, late spring and summer are locked to you because all the berries will be big and thorny. Everything will be filled in. You just cannot get to those parts of the forest, unless you pull out your machete and hack your way through. But in the fall, in the winter, all those things have died down. So you can get to those parts of the forest. So it's so fun how nature kind of like blocks you and then carries you through when you need it to do so. So in the winter, I've learned to really love it because I can access parts of the woods that I can't in the summer. And you see the trees as bones, and there's this beauty and just recognizing like that bone, the body of the tree that is holding all that love, all that wisdom, the abundance, the joy. And you'll see it and witness it as a body. And then you wait a little bit and you see the blooms come out. And then you wait a little bit longer and you see the flowers. And then you stand there looking at the flowers and hoping that all of them get pollinated. You know, you gift them so much love because they gift you so much love. And then you wait, and then all the nuts start coming out. So then, because you have so much love with these trees, you gather some nuts. And as you go walking, as long as you know your areas, so you're not spreading invasive plants, you dump some seeds here and there. And humans are amazing seed spreaders. It's something we've been doing for hundreds of thousands of years. We're really, really good at it. And that's why in South America, when you're looking for indigenous lands or like indigenous villages, archaeologists have now started looking for abundance of edible trees. If they see a lot of passion fruit trees or a lot of guava trees or guayaba trees, they know in that region there were indigenous peoples who were managing and putting out the seeds. Okay. And once they start doing that, they find us.
Okay, that's amazing.
And yes, it's fun.
I love how you're part of this. You know, sometimes we like you're part of what is there also. You're part of what is there. You're part of the magic that happens. Like, I feel like you're one of them, you know, like, and we are all, you know, but sometimes it's hard in our modern life to feel like it, you know, we're very, and when you live in a big city, it's hard to be like, okay, I have to remember my, every morning I wake up, my mantra, I am part of nature, you know, but sometimes it's hard when you don't experience this. And I feel like the piece of wisdom people can really get from you is really to go there. It's simple, but just like going there and learning by themselves. And you learned, and it's very important before going in a forest or eating what is in the forest to know what you're eating, to know where you're going, of course, and learning this. But it's also beautiful to learn things also by yourself because I'm sure they have much more impact in you. And I don't know what piece of advice would you give to people that want to connect to forest more than what I just understood of your passion and connection from it?
Honestly, a few things. One, if you find yourself somewhere on the planet that has been colonized, who lived there? Whose territory are you on? What are their stories and what do they have to say? You will not find a greater expert than the indigenous peoples of those territories. And then once you find out who it was that was there, look up their authors. They have been writing about these places, these stories, since time immemorial. And we have unfortunately come to a space where a lot of outdoor things have been colonized. The feeling of going outdoors is, you know, me being a Latino woman, people are like, that's a white people thing. That is a white man thing to spend your time outdoors. And I'm constantly trying to remind, you know, my friends and people around me that it's not. It's an everybody thing. And once we start reading from different voices, it feels less colonized. And, you know, when we look at the Western way of doing things, they make you want to remember the Latin binomials. For things, they say you don't really know your plants unless you know your Latin binomials. Well, that Latin binomial system is garbage. It's not a great system. They started categorizing things well before they fully understood where categories of things went. And a lot of these plants that were not discovered, that they kind of bumped into, they've had relationships with indigenous people since time immemorial. So these plants have names to them that are not these binomials because, you know, the binomials can be useful. I'm not saying throw the whole system out. But it makes you think only in a very narrow Western way. So start going to indigenous knowledge. Start learning the true names of the plants. Because these names have stories behind them. And not only will they help you know that plant, but it will help you contextualize that plant with the forest around it and the peoples who have interacted within, you know, with that plant. So read indigenous authors. Don't get yourself stuck in having to know the binomials are good to know. Especially when it comes to fungi, I do a really good job at that because they are very tricky, you know, but you have to really listen to indigenous people. And the next thing, pick a plant. Even if it's just the tree on your curb, the tree by your local park, and find out what kind of tree it is. Figure out how old it is. You know, observe that tree. So much of indigenous knowledge comes from observation. Just take the time to stare at the tree, sit underneath the tree. Red cedar taught me how to meditate, and it's because I sat down in front of a red cedar tree and I was stressed out about things. I was like, you know, let me do my deep breaths, and just stopping and creating space. And that within that creation of space, spirit of that plant was able to connect with me. And in my nation, in my tradition, we believe everything has spirit. So stopping and creating space for that spirit to come and interact with you. And it doesn't have to be, you know, like, okay, I'm putting all my hobbies aside and I'm just a tree person. I'm only going to read this. No, you take your time. You know, you don't have to learn everything at once. And that's the thing about nature, is its cycles, right? So you could learn something now, and then next year you'll learn a little bit more about the next group of plants, you know, the next year, but the next little bit. And every year you'll come back and learn something new about each of those plants you thought you had known everything about.
It's so beautiful. You know, sometimes I feel like I'm more connected to nature. I see things in a different way. And then you talk to other people, like I'm talking with you, and you're like, wow, there's so many things to go deeper in, you know, like, and I love ending on this question. It's a difficult question, but I'm curious to know, what ancestor would you like to be? And what is the words you envision in the future?
I think for words, things I want to leave would be love, hope, and joy. Are the things, the seeds that I want to plant for future generations to be able to reap. And I think a lot about what kind of ancestor I want to be. Every time I'm outside reseeding native plant seeds that I come by, I have my desk drawer is literally full of like random native seeds. Plants, like so many. Because literally coming out, oh, this is milkweed. It's an incredible seed. And also you can see the seeds are so different and beautiful. Yeah.
They look like, you know, with food and plants, I know everything, but in French, lentil.
Yeah, they do look like lentils. They do. They really do. And then this one is a northeastern aster. So it really is about literally grabbing some seeds, knowing your plants, and dispersing them. Because I know that when I go out and I redistribute the seeds that I get, I'm giving back to this planet that has given me so much. And I think that act of collecting seeds and regifting seeds is the type of ancestor I want to be. And I want to teach not just my children that, if I decide to have kids, but also our youth around me. And I want to give them hope, because it's kind of scary out there. And we're seeing a lot of, you know, hard things, truths that we must see. We cannot hide from these truths. But if we're not hiding from these truths, we need to come together in community to be able to hold space for these truths, for each other, for our sorrows, for our love, our joy, our hope. And that's the kind of ancestor I want to be. I want to be an ancestor that holds space and that kind of did something in my time so I can make it a little better for the generation in front of me. I want the next, you know, Venezuelan girl who's in diaspora and who's trying to figure out who they are, where they belong in this giant world, to be able to kind of pull on a string and, you know, keep pulling on that string and give them the space to wander and enjoy an abundance that this universe gives us.
This is beautiful. And I loved the seeds. And also it's a metaphor, as you are saying, of, you know, you're planting seeds also by just saying what you're saying in the mind of people. I think it's beautiful.
Well, thank you, Julia.
Yeah, that was amazing. I don't know, Anna, if you have other things you would like to add that you didn't about yourself, forest people.
I think I'm good. My only true last thing that I want to leave is that I hope that everyone that listens to this finds space in their heart for the pursuit of justice, for the pursuit of love, and for the pursuit of abundance. And all of these things, if you're having a hard time trying to figure out where to start, all of these things can be taught to you by the trees, the plants, the lakes, and the rivers around you. If you're feeling scared or if it's a little too much, go back to those lands that have been there. They've been there for you and for the ancestors and for the spirits, and they will continue to be there long after you've been gone. So just go and touch some grass, truthfully and truly.
We're coming back to this this sentence. Yes. Touch the grass. That was beautiful, Anna. Thank you so much. You truly changed something inside me, and yeah, very grateful for this. Thank you.
Thank you for this interchange of energies and ideas, and thank you for holding space for this, Juliet. I am just so honored and grateful to be here with you and just share, you know, some things that have been kind of bubbling around, you know, in my head.
Thank you. The podcast is coming to an end. Thank you so much for listening. You can find Terra Stories on Instagram at terrastories.studio and on LinkedIn. If you liked the episode, talk about it around you, share it with your friends. That's the thing that would give the biggest boost to the podcast. And don't hesitate to write me about the topics or personalities you'd like me to invite or address. I wish you a beautiful day or evening.